designated the symbiotic phase, he begins to recognize others in his universe, not as separate beings, but as extensions of himself. In the following separation-individuation period, extending through ages 2 to 3 years, the child begins to separate and disengage from the primary caregiver, and begins to establish a separate sense of self. Mahler and others consider the child's ability to navigate through this phase of development successfully to be crucial for later mental health. During the entire separation-individuation period, the developing child begins to sketch out boundaries between self and others, a task complicated by two central conflicts: the desire for autonomy versus closeness and dependency needs, and fear of engulfment versus fear of abandonment. A further complicating factor during this time is that the developing infant tends to perceive each individual in the environment as two separate personae. For example, when mother is comforting and sensitive, she is seen as all good. When she is unavailable or unable to comfort and soothe, she is perceived as a separate all bad mother. When she leaves his sight, the infant perceives her as annihilated, gone forever, and cries for her return to relieve the despair and panic. As the child develops, this normal splitting is replaced by a healthier integration of mother's good and bad traits, and separation anxiety is replaced by the knowledge that mother exists even when she is not physically present and will in time return, a phenomenon commonly known as object constancy. Prevailing over these developmental milestones is the child's developing brain, which can sabotage normal adaptation. Mahler divides separation individuation into 4 overlapping subphases. Differentiation phase, 5 to 8 months. In this phase of development, the infant becomes aware of a world separate from mother. Social smiling begins, a reaction to the environment, but directed mostly at mother. Near the end of this phase, the infant displays the opposite side of this same response, stranger anxiety, the recognition of unfamiliar people in the environment. If the relationship with mother is supportive and comforting, reactions to strangers are mainly characterized by curious wonder. If the relationship is unsupportive, anxiety is more prominent. The child begins to divide positive and negative emotions toward other individuals, relying on splitting to cope with these conflicting emotions. Practicing phase, 8 to 16 months. The practicing phase is marked by the infant's increasing ability to move away from mother, first by crawling, then by walking. These short separations are punctuated by frequent reunions to check in and refuel, behavior that demonstrates the child's first ambivalence toward his developing autonomy. Rapprochement phase, 16 to 25 months. In the rapprochement phase, the child's expanding world sparks the recognition that he possesses an identity separate from those around him. Reunions with mother and the need for her approval shape the deepening realization that she and others are separate, real people. It is in the rapprochement phase, however, that both child and mother confront conflicts that will determine future vulnerability to the borderline syndrome. The mother's role during this time is to encourage the child's experiments with individuation, yet simultaneously provide a constant, supportive, refueling reservoir. The normal 2-year-old not only develops a strong bond with parents, but also learns to separate temporarily from them with sadness rather than with rage or tantrum. When reunited with the parent, the child is likely to feel happy as well as angry over the separation. The nurturing mother empathizes with the child and accepts the anger without retaliation. After many separations and reunions, the child develops an enduring sense of self, love and trust for parents, and a healthy ambivalence toward others. The mother of a pre-borderline, however, tends to respond to her child in a different way, either by pushing her child away prematurely and discouraging reunion, perhaps due to her own fear of closeness, or by insisting on a clinging symbiosis, perhaps due to her own fear of abandonment and need for intimacy. In either case, the child becomes burdened by intense fears of abandonment and/or engulfment that are mirrored back to him by mother's own fears. As a result, the child never grows into an emotionally separate human being. Later in life, the borderline's inability to achieve intimacy in personal relationships reflects this infant stage. When an adult borderline confronts closeness, she may resurrect from childhood either the devastating feelings of abandonment that always followed her futile attempts at intimacy, or the feeling of suffocation from mother's constant smothering. Defying such controls risks losing mother's love. Satisfying her risks losing oneself. This fear of engulfment is well illustrated by T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, who, at age 38, writes about his fear of closeness to his overbearing mother. "I have a terror of her knowing anything about my feelings or convictions or way of life. If she knew, they would be damaged, violated, no longer mine." Object constancy phase, 25 to 36 months. By the end of the second year of life, assuming the previous levels of development have progressed satisfactorily, the child enters the object constancy phase, wherein the child recognizes that the absence of mother and other primary caregivers does not automatically mean her annihilation. The child learns to tolerate ambivalence and frustration. The temporary nature of mother's anger is recognized. The child also begins to understand that his own rage will not destroy mother. He begins to appreciate the concept of unconditional love and acceptance, and develops the capacity to share and to empathize. The child becomes more responsive to father and others in the environment. Self-image becomes more positive, despite the self-critical aspects of an emerging conscience. Aiding the child in all these tasks are transitional objects, the familiar comforts, teddy bears, dolls, blankets, that represent mother and are carried everywhere by the child to help ease separations. The object's form, smell, and texture are physical representations of the comforting mother. Transitional objects are one of the first compromises made by the developing child in negotiating the conflict between the need to establish autonomy and the need for dependency. Eventually, in normal development, the transitional object is abandoned when the child is able to internalize a permanent image of a soothing, protective mother figure. Developmental theories propose that the borderline is never able to progress to this object constancy stage. Instead, the borderline is fixated at an earlier developmental phase in which splitting and other defense mechanisms remain prominent. Because they are locked into a continual struggle to achieve object constancy, trust, and a separate identity, adult borderlines continue to rely on transitional objects for soothing. One woman, for example, always carried in her purse a newspaper article that contained quotes from her psychiatrist. When she was under stress, she would take it out, calling it her security blanket. Seeing her doctor's name in print reinforced his existence and his continued interest and concern for her. Princess Diana also took comfort in transitional objects, keeping a menagerie of 20 stuffed animals. "My family," she called them, at the foot of her bed. As her lover, James Hewitt, observed, they lay in a line about 30 cuddly animals, animals that had been with her in her childhood, which she had tucked up in her bed at Park House, and which had comforted her and represented a certain security. When she went on trips, Diana took a favorite teddy bear with her. Ritualized, superstitious acts, when done in extremes, may represent borderline utilization of transitional objects. The ball player who wears the same socks or refuses to shave while in the midst of a hitting streak, for example, may simply be prone to the superstitions that prevail in sports. Only when such behaviors are repeated compulsively and inflexibly and interfere with routine functioning does the person cross the border into the borderline syndrome. Childhood conflicts. The child's evolving sense of object constancy is consistently challenged as he progresses through developmental milestones. The toddler, entranced by fairy tales filled with all good and all bad characters, encounters numerous situations in which he uses splitting as a primary coping strategy. Snow White, for example, can only be conceptualized as all good, and the evil queen as all bad. The fairy tale does not elicit sympathy for a queen who may be a product of a chaotic upbringing, or criticism of the heroine's cohabitation with the seven short guys. Though now trusting mother's permanent presence, the growing child must still contend with the fear of losing her love. The four-year-old who is scolded for being bad may feel threatened with the withdrawal of mother's love. He cannot yet conceive of the possibility that mother may be expressing her own frustrations quite apart from his own behavior, nor has he learned that mother can be angry and yet love him just as much at the same time. Eventually, children are confronted with the separation anxiety of starting school. School phobia is neither a real phobia nor related exclusively to school itself, but instead represents the subtle interplay between the child's anxiety and the reactions of parents who may reinforce the child's clinging with their own ambivalence about the separation. Adolescent conflicts. Separation, individuation issues are repeated during adolescence, when questions of identity and closeness to others once again become vital concerns. During both the rapprochement phase of infancy and adolescence, the child's primary mode of relating is less acting than reacting to others, especially parents. While the two-year-old tries to elicit approval and admiration from parents by molding his identity to emulate caregivers, the adolescent tries to emulate peers or adopts behaviors that are consciously different, even opposite from those of parents. In both stages, the child's behavior is based less on independently determined internal needs than on reacting to the significant people in the immediate environment. Behavior then becomes a quest to discover identity rather than to reinforce an established one. An insecure teenager may ruminate endlessly about her boyfriend in a he loves me, he loves me not fashion. Failure to integrate these positive and negative emotions and to establish a firm, consistent perception of others leads to continued splitting as a defense mechanism. The adolescent's failure to maintain object constancy results in later problems with sustaining consistent, trusting relationships, establishing a core sense of identity, and tolerating anxiety and frustration. Often, entire families adopt a borderline system of interaction, with a family member's undifferentiated identities alternately merging with and separating from each other. Melanie, the adolescent daughter in one such family, closely identified with her chronically depressed mother, who felt abandoned by her philandering husband. With her husband often away from home and her other children of much younger age, the mother fastened onto her teenage daughter, relating intimate details of the unhappy marriage and invading the teenager's privacy with intrusive questions about her friends and activities. Melanie's feelings of responsibility for her mother's happiness interfered to the point where she could not attend to her own needs. She even selected a college nearby so she could continue to live at home. Eventually, Melanie developed anorexia nervosa, which became her primary mechanism for feeling in control, independent, and comforted. Similarly, Melanie's mother felt responsible and guilty for her daughter's illness. The mother sought relief in extravagant spending sprees, which she concealed from her husband, and then covered the bills by stealing money from her daughter's bank account. Mother, father, and daughter were trapped in a dysfunctional family swamp, which they were unwilling to confront, and from which they were unable to escape. In such cases, treatment of the borderline may require treatment of the entire family. Traumas. Major traumas, parental loss, neglect, rejection, physical or sexual abuse, during the early phases of development can increase the probability of BPD in adolescence and adulthood. Indeed, case histories of borderline patients are typically desolate battlefields, scarred by broken homes, chronic abuse, and emotional deprivation. Norman Mailer described the effect of an absent parent on Marilyn Monroe, who never knew her father. Though his absence would contribute to her emotional instability in later life, it would also ironically be one of the motivating forces in her career. Great actors usually discover they have a talent by first searching in desperation for an identity. It is no ordinary identity that will suit them, and no ordinary desperation can drive them. The force that propels a great actor in his youth is insane ambition. Illegitimacy and insanity are the godparents of the great actor. A child who is missing either parent is a study in the search for identity and quickly becomes a candidate for actor, since the most creative way to discover a new and possible identity is through the close fit of a role. Similarly, Princess Diana, rejected by her mother and reared by a cold, withdrawn father, exhibited similar characteristics. "I always used to think that Diana would make a very good actress because she would play out any role she chose," said her former nanny, Mary Clark. Raised in an orphanage during many years of her early childhood, Marilyn had to learn to survive with a minimum of love and attention. It was her self-image that suffered the most and led to her manipulative behavior with lovers later in life. For Diana, her deep feelings of unworthiness, in the eulogizing words of her brother Charles, hindered her relationships with men. "I'd always kept boyfriends away, thought they were all trouble, and I couldn't handle it emotionally. I was very screwed up, I thought." Not all children who are traumatized or abused become borderline adults, of course, nor do all borderline adults have a history of trauma or abuse. Further, most studies on the effects of childhood trauma are based on inferences from adult reports and not on longitudinal studies that follow young children through to adulthood. Finally, other studies have demonstrated less extreme forms of abuse in the histories of borderlines, particularly neglect, sometimes from the father, and a rigid, tight marital bond that excludes adequate protection and support for the child. Nevertheless, the large amount of anecdotal and statistical evidence demonstrates a link between various forms of abuse, neglect, and BPD. Nature versus nurture. The nature-nurture question is, of course, a long-standing and controversial one that applies to many aspects of human behavior. Is one afflicted with BPD because of a biological destiny inherited from parents, or because of the way parents handled or mishandled upbringing? Do the biochemical and neurological signs of the disorder cause the illness, or are they caused by the illness? Why do some people develop BPD in spite of an apparently healthy upbringing? Why do others, burdened with a background filled with trauma and abuse, not develop it? These chicken or egg dilemmas can lead to false assumptions. For example, one might conclude, based on developmental theories, that the causal direction is strictly downward. That is, an aloof, detached mother would produce an insecure borderline child. But the relationship might be more complex, more interactive than that. A colicky, unresponsive, unattractive infant may generate disappointment and detachment in the mother. Regardless of which comes first, both continue to interact and perpetuate interpersonal patterns, which may endure over many years and extend to other relationships. The mitigating effects of other factors, a supportive father, accepting family and friends, superior education, physical and mental abilities, will help determine the ultimate emotional health of the individual. Though no evidence supports a specific BPD gene, humans may inherit chromosomal vulnerabilities that are later expressed as a particular illness, depending on a variety of contributing factors, childhood frustrations and traumas, specific stress events in life, healthy nutrition, access to healthcare, and so on. Just as some have postulated that heritable biological defects in the body's metabolism of alcohol may be associated with an individual's propensity to develop alcoholism, so there may exist a genetic predisposition for BPD, involving a biological weakness in stabilizing mood and impulses. As many borderlines learn that they must reject the either-or, black-or-white ways of thinking, researchers are beginning to appreciate that the most likely model for BPD, and for most medical and psychiatric illnesses, recognizes multiple contributing factors, nature and nurture, working and interacting simultaneously. Borderline personality is a complex tapestry, richly embroidered with innumerable intersecting threads. Chapter 4. The Borderline Society. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Proverbs, chapter 29, verse 18. States are as the men are. They grow out of human characters. From Plato's Republic. From the beginning, Lisa Barlow couldn't do anything right. Her older brother was the golden boy. Good grades, polite, athletic, perfect. Her younger sister, who had asthma, was also lavished with constant attention. Lisa was never good enough, especially in the eyes of her father. She remembered how he constantly reminded all three children that he had started with nothing, that his parents had no money, didn't care about him, and drank too much. But he had prevailed. He had worked his way through high school, college, and through several promotions at a national investment bank. In 1999, he made a fortune in the dot-com stock boom, only to lose it all a year later after some professional missteps. Lisa's earliest memories of her mother were of her lying on the couch, either sick or in pain, ordering Lisa to do one chore or another around the house. Lisa tried hard to care for her mother and to persuade her to stop taking the pain pills and tranquilizers that seemed to make her so foggy and distant. Lisa felt that if she was just good enough, she could not only make her mother better, but also please her father. Though her grades were always excellent, even better than her brother's, her father always maligned her achievements. The course was too easy, or she could have done better than a B+ or an A-. At one point, she thought she might want to become a doctor, but her father convinced her she would never make it. In her childhood and adolescence, the Barlows moved constantly, following whatever job or promotion her father chased after. From Omaha to St. Louis to Chicago and finally to New York. Lisa hated these moves and realized later that she resented her mother for never objecting to them. Every couple of years, Lisa would be packed up and shipped like baggage to a strange new city where she would attend a new school filled with strange new students. Years later, she would recount these experiences to her therapist as feeling like a kidnap victim or a slave. By the time the family arrived in New York, Lisa was in high school. She vowed never to make another friend, so she would never have to say goodbye again. The family moved into a posh home in a posh New York suburb. Sure, the house was bigger and the lawn more manicured, but that didn't come close to compensating for the friendships she left behind. Her father rarely came home in the evenings, and when he did, it was late, and he would start drinking and railing against Lisa and her mother for doing nothing all day. When her father drank too much, he became violent, sometimes hitting the kids harder than he intended. The most frightening time of all was when he was drunk and their mother was spaced out on pain pills. Then there was no one to take care of the family, except Lisa, and she hated it. In 2000, everything started coming apart. Somehow her father's firm, or her father himself, she was never sure which, lost everything when the stock market crashed. Her father was suddenly in danger of losing his job, and if he did, the Barlows would have to move again to a smaller house in a less desirable neighborhood. He seemed to blame his family, and especially Lisa. And then, on a clear, bright morning in September 2001, Lisa came downstairs to find her father lying on the sofa, tears streaming down his cheeks. Had it not been for a hangover from a drinking bout the night before, he would have been killed in his office in the World Trade Center. For months afterward, her father was helpless, and so was her mother. They eventually divorced 6 months later. During this period, Lisa felt lost and isolated. It was similar to the way she felt in biology class, when she'd look around the room and observe the other kids squinting into their microscopes, taking notes, apparently knowing exactly what to do, while she became queasy, not quite understanding what was expected of her and feeling too scared to ask for help. After a while, she just stopped trying. In high school, she began to hang out with the wrong kids. She made sure her parents saw them and how freaky they dressed. The bodies of many of her friends were covered, almost literally, with tattoos and body piercings. And the local tattoo parlor became a second home for Lisa as well. Because her father insisted she couldn't make it as a doctor, Lisa went into nursing. At her first hospital job, she met a free spirit who wanted to bring his nursing expertise to underprivileged areas. Lisa was enthralled by him, and they married soon after meeting. His habitual social drinking became more prominent as the months went by, and he began hitting her. Bruised and battered, Lisa still felt it was her fault. She just wasn't good enough, couldn't make him happy. She had no friends, she said, because he wouldn't let her have any. But deep down, she knew it was due more to her own fears of closeness. She was relieved when he finally left her. She had wanted the split, but couldn't cut the cord herself. But after the relief came fear. Now what do I do? Between the divorce settlement and her salary, Lisa had enough money to return to school. This time she was determined to be a doctor, and much to her father's shock, was accepted into medical school. She was starting to feel good again, valued and respected. But then, in medical school, the self-doubts returned. Her supervisors said she was too slow, clumsy with simple procedures, disorganized. They criticized her for not ordering the right tests or getting lab results back in time. Only with the patients did she feel comfortable. With them, she could be whomever she needed to be, kind and compassionate when that was needed, confrontational and demanding when that was called for. Lisa also experienced a great deal of prejudice in medical school. She was older than most of the other students, she had a much different background, and she was a woman. Many of the patients called her nurse, and some of the male patients didn't want no lady doctor. She was hurt and angry because, like her parents, society and its institutions had also robbed her of her dignity. The disintegrating culture. Psychological theories take on a different dimension when looked upon in light of the culture and time period from which they emanate. At the turn of the century, for instance, when Freud was formulating the system that would become the foundation of modern psychiatric thought, the cultural context was a formally structured Victorian society. His theory that the primary origins of neuroses were the repression of unacceptable thoughts and feelings, aggressive and especially sexual, was entirely logical in this strict social context. Now, over a century later, aggressive and sexual instincts are expressed more openly, and the social milieu is much more confused. What it means to be a man or a woman is much more ambiguous in modern Western civilization than in turn-of-the-century Europe. Social, economic, and political structures are less fixed. The family unit and cultural roles are less defined, and the very concept of traditional is unclear. Though social factors may not be direct causes of BPD or other forms of mental illness, they are, at the least, important indirect influences. Social factors interact with BPD in several ways and cannot be overlooked. First, if borderline pathology originates early in life, and much of the evidence points in this direction, an increase in the pathology is likely tied to the changing social patterns of family structure and parent-child interaction. In this regard, it is worthwhile to examine social changes in the area of child-raising patterns, stability of home life, and child abuse and neglect. Second, social changes of a more general nature have an exacerbative effect on people already suffering from the borderline syndrome. The lack of structure in American society, for example, is especially difficult for borderlines to handle, since they typically have immense problems creating structure for themselves. Women's shifting role patterns, career versus homemaker, for example, tend to aggravate identity problems. Indeed, some researchers attribute the prominence of BPD among women to this social role conflict, now so widespread in our society. The increased severity of BPD in these cases may in turn be transmitted to future generations through parent-child interactions, multiplying the effects over time. Third, the growing recognition of personality disorders in general, and borderline personality more specifically, may be seen as a natural and inevitable response to, or an expression of, our contemporary culture. As Christopher Lash noted in The Culture of Narcissism, every society reproduces its culture, its norms, its underlying assumptions, its modes of organizing experience, in the individual in the form of personality. As Durkheim said, personality is the individual socialized. For many, American culture has lost contact with the past and remains unconnected to the future. The flooding of technical advancement and information that swept over the late 20th and early 21st centuries, much of it involving computers, PDAs, cell phones, and so on, often requires greater individual commitment to solitary study and practice, thus sacrificing opportunities for real social interaction. Indeed, the preoccupation, some would say obsession, with computers and other digital gadgetry, especially among the young in what is commonly called social media, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, YouTube, etc., may be resulting ironically in more self-absorption and less physical interaction. Texting, blogging, posting, and tweeting all avoid eye contact. Increasing divorce rates, expanding use of daycare, and greater geographical mobility have all contributed to a society that lacks constancy and reliability. Personal, intimate, lasting relationships become difficult or even impossible to achieve, and deep-seated loneliness, self-absorption, emptiness, anxiety, depression, and loss of self-esteem ensue. The borderline syndrome represents a pathological response to these stresses. Without outside sources of stability and validation of worthiness, borderline symptoms of black-and-white thinking, self-destructiveness, extreme mood changes, impulsivity, poor relationships, impaired sense of identity, and anger become understandable reactions to our culture's tensions. Borderline traits, which may be present to some extent in most people, are being elicited, perhaps even bred, on a wide scale by the prevailing social conditions. New York Times writer Lewis Sass puts it this way: "Each culture probably needs its own scapegoats as expressions of society's ills, just as the hysterics of Freud's day exemplified the sexual repression of that era. The borderline, whose identity is split into many pieces, represents the fracturing of stable units in our society." Though conventional wisdom presumes that borderline pathology has increased over the last few decades, some psychiatrists believe that the symptoms were just as common early in the 20th century. They claim that the change is not in the prevalence of the disorder, but in the fact that it is now officially identified and defined, and so merely diagnosed more frequently. Even some of Freud's early cases, scrutinized in the light of current criteria, might be diagnosed today as borderline personalities. This possibility, however, by no means diminishes the importance of the growing number of borderline patients who are ending up in psychiatrists' offices and of the growing recognition of borderline characteristics in the general population. In fact, the major reason why it has been identified and covered so widely in the clinical literature is its prevalence in both therapeutic settings and the general culture. The breakdown of structure, a fragmented society. Few would dispute the notion that society has become more fragmented since the end of World War II. Family structures in place for decades, the nuclear family, extended family, one-wage-earner households, geographical stability, have been replaced by a wide assortment of patterns, movements, and trends. Divorce rates have soared. Drug and alcohol abuse and child neglect and abuse have skyrocketed. Crime, terrorism, and political assassination have become widespread, at times almost commonplace. Periods of economic uncertainty, exemplified in roller coaster boom and bust scenarios, have become the rule, not the exception. Some of these changes may be related to society's failure to achieve a kind of social rapprochement. As noted in Chapter 3, during the separation individuation phase, the infant ventures cautiously away from mother, but returns to her reassuring warmth, familiarity, and acceptance. Disruption of this rapprochement cycle often results in a lack of trust, disturbed relationships, emptiness, anxiety, and an uncertain self-image, characteristics that make up the borderline syndrome. Similarly, it may be seen that contemporary culture interferes with a healthy social rapprochement by obstructing access to comforting anchors. At no time has this disruption been more evident than in the first decade of the 21st century, racked as it has been by economic collapse, recession, loss of jobs, foreclosures, and so on. In most areas of the country, the need for two incomes to maintain a decent standard of living forces many parents to relinquish parenting duties to others. Paid parental leave or on-site daycare for new parents is still relatively rare and almost always limited. Jobs, as well as economic and social pressures, encourage frequent moves, and this geographical mobility in turn removes us from our stabilizing roots, as it did in Lisa's family. We are losing, or have already lost, the comforts of neighborly nearby family and consistent social roles. When the accoutrements of custom disappear, they may be replaced by a sense of abandonment, of being adrift in uncharted waters. Our children lack a sense of history and belonging, of an anchored presence in the world. To establish a sense of control and comforting familiarity in an alienating society, the individual may resort to a wide range of pathological behavior, substance addiction, eating disorders, criminal behaviors, and so on. Society's failure to provide rapprochement with reassuring, stabilizing bonds is reflected in the relentless series of sweeping societal movements over the past 50 years. We roller-coastered from the explosive, other-directed fight for social justice we decade of the 1960s to the narcissistic me decade of the 1970s to the materialistic look-out-for-number-one we decade of the 1980s. The relatively prosperous and stable 1990s was followed by the turbulent 2000s, financial boom and busts, natural catastrophes, Katrina and other hurricanes, major tsunamis, earthquakes, and fires, a prolonged war, and socio-political movements, anti-war, gay rights, bringing us almost full circle back to the 1960s. One of the big losers in these tectonic shifts has been group loyalties, devotion to family, neighborhood, church, occupation, and country. As society continues to foster detachment from people and institutions that provide reassuring rapprochement, individuals are responding in ways that virtually define the borderline syndrome. Decreased sense of validated identity, worsening interpersonal relationships, isolation and loneliness, boredom, and, without the stabilizing force of group pressures, impulsivity. Like the world of the borderline, ours, in many ways, is a world of massive contradictions. We presume to believe in peace, yet our streets, movies, television, and sports are filled with aggression and violence. We are a nation virtually founded on the principle of help thy neighbor, yet we have become one of the most politically conservative, self-absorbed, and materialistic societies in the history of humankind. Assertiveness and action are encouraged. Reflection and introspection are equated with weakness and incompetency. Contemporary social forces implore us to embrace a mythical polarity, black or white, right or wrong, good or bad, relying on our nostalgia for simpler times for our own childhoods. The political system presents candidates who adopt polar stances. I'm right, the other guy's wrong. America is good. The Soviet Union is the evil empire. Iran, Iraq, and North Korea are the axis of evil. Religious factions exhort us to believe that theirs is the only route to salvation. The legal system, built on the premise that one is either guilty or not guilty, with little or no room for gray areas, perpetuates the myth that life is intrinsically fair and justice can be attained. That is, when something bad does happen, it necessarily follows that it is someone else's fault and that person should pay. The flood of information and leisure alternatives makes it difficult to establish priorities in living. Ideally, we as individuals and as a society attempt to achieve a balance between nurturing the body and the mind, between work and leisure, between altruism and self-interest. But in an increasingly materialistic society, it is a small step from assertiveness to aggressiveness, from individualism to alienation, from self-preservation to self-absorption. The ever-growing reverence for technology has led to an obsessive pursuit of precision. Calculators replaced memorized multiplication tables and slide rules, and then were replaced by computers, which have become omnipresent in almost every aspect of our lives, our cars, our appliances, our cell phones, running whatever machine or device they are a part of. The microwave relieves adults from the chore of cooking. Velcro absolves children of learning how to tie shoelaces. Creativity and intellectual diligence are sacrificed to convenience and precision. All these attempts to impose order and fairness on a naturally random and unfair universe endorse the borderline's futile struggle to choose only black or white, right or wrong, good or bad. But the world is neither intrinsically fair nor exact. It is composed of subtleties that require less simplistic approaches. A healthy civilization can accept the uncomfortable ambiguities. Attempts to eradicate or ignore uncertainty tend only to encourage a borderline society. We would be naive to believe that the cumulative effect of all this change, the excruciating pull of opposing forces, has had no effect on our psyches. In a sense, we all live in a kind of borderland between the prosperous, healthy, high-technology America on the one hand, and the underbelly of poverty, homelessness, drug abuse, and mental illness on the other. Between the dream of a sane, safe, secure world and the insane nightmare of nuclear holocaust. The price tag of social change has come in the form of stress and stress-related physical disorders, such as heart attacks, strokes, and hypertension. We must now confront the possibility that mental illness has become part of the psychological price. Dread of the future. Over the past four decades, therapeutic settings have seen a basic change in defining psychopathology, from symptom neuroses to character disorders. As far back as 1975, psychiatrist Peter L. Giovaccini wrote, "Clinicians are constantly faced with the seemingly increasing number of patients who do not fit current diagnostic categories. They suffer not from definitive symptoms, but from vague, ill-defined complaints. When I refer to this type of patient, practically everyone knows to whom I am referring." Beginning in the 1980s, such reports have become commonplace as personality disorders have replaced classical neurosis as the prominent pathology. Which social and cultural factors have influenced this change in pathology? Many believe that one factor is our devaluation of the past. To live for the moment is the prevailing passion. To live for yourself, not for your predecessors or posterity. We are fast losing the sense of historical continuity, the sense of belonging to a succession of generations originating in the past and stretching into the future. This loss of historical continuity reaches both backward and forward. Devaluation of the past breaks the perceptual link to the future, which becomes a vast unknown, a source of dread as much as hope. A vast quicksand from which it becomes incredibly difficult to extricate oneself. Time is perceived as isolated points instead of as a logical, continuous string of events influenced by past achievement, present action, and anticipation of the future. The looming possibility of a catastrophic event, the threat of nuclear annihilation, another massive terrorist attack like 9/11, environmental destruction due to global warming, and so on, contributes to our lack of faith in the past and our dread of the future. Empirical studies with adolescents and children consistently show awareness of the danger, hopelessness about surviving, a shortened time perspective, and pessimism about being able to reach life goals. Suicide is mentioned again and again as a strategy for dealing with the threat. Other studies have found that the threat of nuclear war rushes children to a kind of early adulthood, similar to the type witnessed in pre-borderline children, like Lisa, who are forced to take control of families that are out of control due to BPD, alcoholism, and other mental disorders. Many U.S. youth ages 14 to 22 expect to die before age 30, according to a 2008 study published in the Journal of Adolescent Health. About 1 out of 15 young people, 6.7%, expressed such unrealistic fatalism, the study concludes. The findings are based on 4 years of survey data totaling 4,201 adolescents conducted between 2002 and 2005 by the Adolescent Risk Communication Institute of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Despite a decline in the suicide rate for 10 to 24-year-olds, suicide remains the third leading cause of death in this age group. The borderline, as we have seen, personifies this orientation to the now. With little interest in the past, the borderline is almost a cultural amnesiac. His cupboard of warm memories, which sustain most of us in troubled times, is bare. As a result, he is doomed to suffer torment with no breathers, no cache of memories of happier times to get him through the tough periods. Unable to learn from his mistakes, he is doomed to repeat them. Parents who fear the future are not likely to be engrossed by the needs of the next generation. A modern parent, emotionally detached and alienated, yet at the same time pampering and overindulgent, becomes a likely candidate to mold future borderline personalities. The jungle of interpersonal relationships. Perhaps the hallmark social changes over the last 50 years have come in the area of sexual mores, roles, and practices. From the suppressed sexuality of the 1950s to the free love and open marriage trends of the 1960s sexual revolution to the massive sexual re-evaluation in the 1980s, resulting in large part from the fear of AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases, to the gay and lesbian movements over the last decade, the massive spread of dating and matching websites and social media has made it so easy to establish personal contact that the old brick-and-mortar pickup bar is becoming increasingly irrelevant. Innocent or illicit romantic or sexual relationships can now be initiated with a few keyboard strokes or a text message. The jury is out on whether cyberspace has civilized the world of interpersonal relationships or turned it into more of a dangerous jungle than it ever was. As a result of these and other societal forces, deep and lasting friendships, love affairs, and marriages have become increasingly difficult to achieve and maintain. 60% of marriages for couples between the ages of 20 and 25 end in divorce. The number is 50% for those over 25. Even back in 1982, Lash noted that as social life becomes more and more warlike and barbaric, personal relations, which ostensibly provide relief from those conditions, take on the character of combat. Ironically, borderlines may be well suited for this kind of combat. The narcissistic man's need to dominate and be idolized fits well with the borderline woman's ambivalent need to be controlled and punished. Borderline women, as we saw with Lisa at the start of this chapter, often marry at a young age to escape the chaos of family life. They cling to dominating husbands with whom they recreate the miasma of home life. Both may enter a kind of slap, thanks, I needed that, sadomasochistic dyad. Less typical, but still common, is a reversal of these roles, with a borderline male linked with a narcissistic female partner. Masochism is a prominent characteristic of borderline relationships. Dependency coupled with pain elicits the familiar refrain, love hurts. As a child, the borderline experiences pain and confusion in trying to establish a maturing relationship with his mother or primary caregiver. Later in life, other partners, spouse, friends, teacher, employer, minister, doctor, renew this early confusion. Criticism or abuse particularly reinforces the borderline's self-image of worthlessness. Lisa's later relationships with her husband and supervisors, for example, recapitulated the profound feelings of worthlessness that were ingrained by her father's constant criticisms. Sometimes, the borderline's masochistic suffering transforms into sadism. For example, Anne would sometimes encourage her husband Larry to drink, knowing about his drinking problem. Then she would instigate a fight, fully aware of Larry's violent propensities when drunk. Following a beating, Anne would wear her bruises like battle ribbons, reminding Larry of his violence and insisting they go out in public, where Anne would explain away her marks as accidents, such as running into doors. After each episode, Larry would feel profoundly regretful and humiliated, while Anne would present herself as a long-suffering martyr. In this way, Anne used her beatings to exact punishment from Larry. The identification of the real victim in this relationship becomes increasingly vague. Even when a relationship is apparently ruptured, the borderline comes crawling back for more punishment, feeling he deserves the denigration. The punishment is comfortably familiar, easier to cope with than the frightening prospect of solitude or a different partner. A typical scenario for modern social relationships is the overlapping lover pattern, commonly called shingling, establishing a new romance before severing a current one. The borderline exemplifies this constant need for partnership. As the borderline climbs the jungle gym of relationships, he cannot let go of the lower bar until he has firmly grasped the higher one. Typically, the borderline will not leave his current abusive spouse until a new white knight is at least visible on the horizon. Periods of relaxed social sexual mores and less structured romantic relationships, such as in the late 1960s and 1970s, are more difficult for borderlines to handle. Increased freedom and lack of structure paradoxically imprison the borderline, who is severely handicapped in devising his own individual system of values. Conversely, the sexual withdrawal period of the late 1980s, due in part to the AIDS epidemic, can be ironically therapeutic for borderline personalities. Social fears enforce strict boundaries that can be crossed only at the risk of great physical harm. Impulsivity and promiscuity now have severe penalties in the form of STDs, violent sexual deviance, and so on. This external structure can help protect the borderline from his own self-destructiveness. Shifting gender role patterns. Earlier in the last century, social roles were fewer, well-defined, and much more easily combined. Mother was domestic, working in the home, in charge of the children. Outside interests, such as school involvement, hobbies, and charity work, flowed naturally from these duties. Father's work and community visibility also combined smoothly, and together their roles worked synchronously. The complexities of modern society, however, dictate that the individual develop a plethora of social roles, many of which do not combine so easily. The working mother, for example, has two distinct roles and must struggle to perform both well. The policies of most employers demand that the working mom keep the home and workplace separate. As a result, many mothers feel guilty or embarrassed when problems from one impact the other. A working father also finds work and home roles compartmentalized. He is no longer the owner of the local grocery who lives above the store. More likely, he works miles from home and has much less time to be with his family. What's more, the modern dad plays an increasingly participatory role with familial responsibility. Shifting role patterns over the last 25 years are central to theories on why BPD is identified more commonly in women. In the past, a woman had essentially one life course: getting married, usually in her late teens or early 20s, having children, staying in the home to raise those children, and repressing any career ambitions. Today, in contrast, a young woman is faced with a bewildering array of role models and expectations, from the single career woman to the married career woman, to the traditional nurturing mother, to the supermom, who strives to combine marriage, career, and children successfully. Men have also experienced new roles and expectations, of course, but not nearly so wide-ranging, nor conflicting, as women. Today, men are expected to be more sensitive and open, and to take a larger part in child-raising than in previous eras. Yet these qualities and responsibilities usually fit within the overall role of provider or co-provider. It is the rare man who, for example, abandons career ambitions for the role of house husband, nor is this expected of him. Men have fewer adjustments to make during the evolution of relationships and marriages. For example, relocations are usually dictated by the man's career needs, since he is most often the primary wage earner. Throughout pregnancy, birth, and child rearing, few changes occur in the man's day-to-day reality. The woman not only endures the physical demands of pregnancy and childbirth, and must leave her job to give birth, but it is also she who must make the transition back to work or give up her career. And yet in many dual-earner households, although it may not be openly stated, the woman simply assumes the primary responsibility for the maintenance of the home. She is the one who usually adjusts her plans to stay home with a sick child or waits for the repairman to come. Though women have struggled successfully to achieve increased social and career options, they may have had to pay an exacting price in the process, excruciating life decisions about career, families, and children, strains on their relationships with their children and husband, the stress resulting from making and living with these decisions, and confusion about who they are and who they want to be. From this perspective, it is understandable that women should be more closely associated with BPD, a disorder in which identity and role confusion are such central components. Sexual orientation and borderlines. Sexual orientation may also play a part in the borderline's role confusion. In line with this theory, some researchers estimate a significantly increased rate of sexual perversions among borderlines. Environmental factors that may theoretically contribute to the development of sexual identity include lack of role models, sexual assaults, an insatiable need for affection and attention, discomfort with one's own body, and inconsistent sexual information. Family and child-rearing patterns. Since the end of World War II, our society has experienced striking changes in family and child-rearing patterns. The institution of the nuclear family has been in steady decline, largely due to divorce. Half of all American children born in the 1990s will spend some part of their childhood in a single-parent home. Alternative family structures, such as blended families, in which a single parent with children combines with another one-parent household to form a new family unit, have led to situations in which many children are raised by persons other than their birth parents. According to one study, only 63% of American children grow up with both biological parents, the lowest percentage in the Western world. Due to increased geographical mobility, among other factors, the traditional extended family, with grandparents, siblings, cousins, and other family relations living in close proximity, is almost extinct, leaving the nuclear family virtually unsupported. The number of women working outside the home has increased dramatically. 40% of working women are mothers of children under age 18. 71% of all single mothers are employed. As a result of women working outside the home, more children than ever before are being placed in various forms of daycare, and at a much earlier age. The number of infants in daycare increased 45% during the 1980s. The evidence clearly suggests that the incidence of child physical and sexual abuse has increased significantly over the past 25 years. What are the psychological effects of these child-rearing changes on both children and parents? Though many of these changes, such as blended families, are too new to be the subject of intensive long-term studies, psychiatrists and developmental experts generally agree that children growing up in settings marked by turmoil, instability, or abuse are at much greater risk for emotional and mental problems in adolescence and adulthood. Moreover, parents in such environments are much more likely to develop stress, guilt, depression, lower self-esteem, all characteristics associated with BPD. Child abuse and neglect, destroyer of trust. Child abuse and neglect have become significant health problems. In 2007, about 5.8 million children were involved in an estimated 3.2 million child abuse reports and allegations in the United States. Some studies estimate that 25% of girls experience some form of sexual abuse, from parents or others, by the time they reach adulthood. Characteristics of physically abused preschool-age children include inhibition, depression, attachment difficulties, behavior problems, such as hyperactivity and severe tantrums, poor impulse control, aggressiveness, and peer relation problems. Violence begets violence, said John Lennon, and this is particularly true in the case of battered children, because those who are abused often become abusers themselves. This problem can self-perpetuate over many decades and generations. In fact, about 30% of abused and neglected children will later abuse their own children, continuing the vicious cycle. The incidence of abuse or neglect among borderlines is high enough to be a factor that separates BPD from other personality disorders. Verbal or psychological abuse is the most common form, followed by physical and then sexual abuse. Physical and sexual abuse may be more dramatic in nature, but the emotionally abused child can suffer total loss of self-esteem. Emotional child abuse can take several forms: degradation, constantly devaluing the child's achievements and magnifying misbehavior. After a while, the child becomes convinced that he really is bad or worthless. Unavailability. Psychologically absent parents show little interest in the child's development and provide no affection in times of need. Domination. Use of extreme threats to control the child's behavior. Some child development experts have compared this form of abuse to the techniques used by terrorists to brainwash captives. Recall from Lisa's story that she probably suffered all of these forms of emotional abuse. Her father hammered her constantly that she was not good enough. Her mother rarely stood up for Lisa, almost always deferring to her husband in all important decisions, and Lisa perceived the family's numerous relocations as kidnappings. The pattern of the neglected child, as described by psychologist Hugh Misseldine, mirrors the dilemmas of borderlines in later life. If you suffered from neglect in childhood, it may cause you to go from one person to another, hoping that someone will supply whatever is missing. You may not be able to care much about yourself and think marriage will end this, and then find yourself in the alarming situation of being married but emotionally unattached. Moreover, the person who has neglect in his background is always restless and anxious because he cannot obtain emotional satisfaction. These restless, impulsive moves help to create the illusion of living emotionally. Such a person may, for example, be engaged to be married to one person and simultaneously be maintaining sexual relationships with two or three others. Anyone who offers admiration and respect has appeal to them, and because their need for affection is so great, their ability to discriminate is severely impaired. From what we understand of the roots of BPD, abuse, neglect, or prolonged separations early in childhood can greatly disrupt the developing infant's establishment of trust. Self-esteem and autonomy are crippled. The abilities to cope with separation and to form identity do not proceed normally. As they become adults, abused children may recapitulate frustrating relationships with others. Pain and punishment may become associated with closeness. They come to believe that love hurts. As the borderline matures, self-mutilation may become the proxy for the abusive parent. Children of divorce, the disappearing father. Due primarily to divorce, more children than ever before are being raised without the physical and/or emotional presence of their father. Because most courts award children to the mother in custody cases, the large majority of single-parent homes are headed by mothers. Even in cases of joint custody or liberal visitation rights, the father, who is more likely to remarry sooner after divorce and start a new family, often fades from the child's upbringing. The recent trend in child raising toward a more equal sharing of parental responsibilities between mother and father makes divorce even more upsetting for the child. Children clearly benefit from dual parenting, but they also lose more when the marriage dissolves, especially if the breakup occurs during the formative years when the child still has many crucial developmental stages to hurdle. Studies on the effects of divorce typically report profound upset, neediness, regression, and acute separation anxiety related to fears of abandonment in children of preschool age. A significant number are found to be depressed or antisocial in later stages of childhood. Indeed, teens living in single-parent families are not only more likely to commit suicide, but also more likely to suffer from psychological disorders when compared to teens living in intact families. During separation and divorce, the child's need for physical intimacy increases. For example, it is typical for a child at the time of separation to ask a parent to sleep with him. If the practice continues and sleeping in the same bed becomes the parent's need as well, the child's own sense of autonomy and bodily integrity may be threatened. This, combined with the loneliness and severe narcissistic injury caused by the divorce, places some children at high risk for developmental arrest, or if the need for affection and reassurance becomes desperate, for sexual abuse. A father separated from the home may demand more time with the child in order to relieve his own feelings of loneliness and deprivation. If the child becomes a lightning rod for his father's resentment and bitterness, he may again be at higher risk for abuse. In many situations of parental separation, the child becomes the pawn in a destructive battle between his parents. David, a divorced father who usually ignored his visitation privileges, suddenly demanded that his daughter stay with him whenever he was angry at her mother. These visits were usually unpleasant for the child as well as for her father and his new family, yet were used as punishment for his ex-wife, who would feel guilty and powerless at his demands. Bobby became embroiled in conflicts between his divorced parents when his mother periodically took his father back to court to extract more child support monies. Bribes of material gifts or threats to cut off support for school or home maintenance are common weapons used between continuously skirmishing parents. The bribes and threats are usually more harmful to the children than they are to the parents. Children may even be drawn into court battles and forced to testify about their parents. In these situations, neither the parents, nor the courts, nor social welfare organizations can protect the child, who is often left with a sense of overwhelming helplessness. Conflicts continue despite his input, or of intoxicating power. His testimony controls the battle between his parents. He may feel enraged at his predicament, and yet fearful that he could be abandoned by everyone. All of this becomes fertile ground for the development of borderline pathology. In addition to divorce, other powerful societal forces have contributed to the absent father syndrome. The past half century has witnessed the maturing of children of thousands of war veterans, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam, Persian Gulf, Iraq, not to mention many prison camp and concentration camp survivors. Not only were many of these fathers absent during significant portions of their children's development, but many were found to develop post-traumatic stress disorders and delayed mourning, impacted grief, related to combat that also